I'll have you know the contents of that dumpster are private. You stick your nose in, you'll be violating attorney dumpster confidentiality.
I just wanted to say hello.
Oh. Hello.
All right, we're done.
You think the language in the Second Amendment is clear enough? You know, about the right to bear arms?
Of course it's clear. Every American has the right to hang a pair of bear arms on their wall. How could that possibly be misconstrued?
All right, fantastic then. Wait, you know what? Before we send this to the printer, let's take that abortion thing out.
Oh, come on. I move for a hearing on the matter.
What? You want me to have a special motion on the admissibility of the word asshole?
Well, let me have ass then. That's close enough.
What law school did you go to?
I'll agree to it, Your Honor.
You will? Why?
I don't want any interlocutory appeals.
What are you, a comedy team?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that breaks down the law behind all the news stories you care about. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hey guys, I'm Liz Dye. With me is Andrew Torres, and this is Opening Arguments, episode 747.
Hey Liz, how you doing?
Oh my God, it's crazy on my beat. It's crazy. Did you see that E. Jean Carroll's going to re-amend her complaint to add in the comments that Trump made in that town hall on CNN?
Wow. Good for her. I mean, because that was extra strength gross. So good on her.
And Trump has filed another crazy-ass lawsuit. You and I are still trying to break this one down. It's not Trump. It's Trump Media and Technology Group, the company that Devin Nunes runs.
Right.
And Devin Nunes has brought his Sparkle Magic libel slander lawyer, Stephen Biss, along for the ride. And they found a local counsel who's apparently a one- or two-lawyer personal injury guy. So
yeah, workers' comp guy, right? Yeah,
something awesome. It's going to be awesome. We're going to dive into that because that's going to require us to look at some SEC reports and
and
take a minute.
They've sued the Washington Post for what, $3.8 billion?
It's insane. I mean, knock yourself out. Yeah, the $3.8 billion lawsuit bought by Stephen Biss and a workers' comp guy. Cool. This is awesome. Anyway, but we're going to try not to talk any more about Trump during this show, because we're going to talk all about Tiny D, Ron DeSantis.
I cannot wait.
Okay. Well, it's been a rough week for little Ron, who looks to be about to lose yet another battle in his woke war on Disney. It seems like Meatball Ron's own Republican allies in the Florida legislature may have mooted his lawsuit seeking to invalidate the Princess contract that the Reedy Creek Improvement District signed with Disney, giving it the bulk of its powers on the way out. This comes on the heels of Disney announcing that it isn't going to build a $1 billion office complex in Lake Nona, Florida after all. So fight woke, go broke. Is that how they put it?
Nice.
Okay. So none of this is making DeSantis look like a viable presidential candidate to challenge Donald Trump. Not that he looked like it to either one of us ever, but this shit ain't helping.
Yeah. And I mean, look, Ron DeSantis is, can you culture warrior your way into the White House with literally no other credentials whatsoever? And I'm hoping that's no. I don't know.
I mean, yeah, that's good. On the other hand, the alternative is Donald Trump. So,
we promise
not to talk about him anymore. So,
a lot of low cards in that hand. So,
yes, that's a funny thing that you say. All right, so let's talk about it.
Yeah.
To recap, Florida passed this gross "Don't Say Gay" bill in 2022 that made it illegal to acknowledge that LGBTQ people exist in schools. So Disney said nothing, despite positioning itself as a gay-friendly company which supports its LGBTQ cast members, which is what it calls employees.
Mm-hmm.
Only after the law had been enacted and after those cast members staged walkouts to protest the company's silence did the CEO, Bob Chapek, put out a statement saying, "Our goal as a company is for this law to be repealed by the legislature or struck down in the courts, and we remain committed to supporting the national and state organizations working to achieve that."
Yeah, way to take a brave stand there. Like, particular, we would like for this maybe to not be a thing, particularly if we don't have to do a damn thing about it.
Yeah, brave stand. At that point, Governor Pissbaby Snowflake lost his mind and called Disney California corporate executives and promised to fight back when people are threatening our parents and threatening our kids, which is a weird thing to say about a company responsible for upwards of $60 billion in cash flowing every single year into Central Florida's economy.
Wow.
But then DeSantis and his allies in the state legislature said the quiet part super loud. State Rep Randy Fine really actually said, you kick the hornet's nest, things come up. And I will say this, you got me on one thing. This bill does target one company. It targets the Walt Disney Company.
They just can't help stepping on it. Anyway, nope. You know, since then, DeSantis and his allies have renamed the Reedy Creek Improvement District the not at all Orwellian Central Florida Oversight Tourism Board. He's replaced the formerly democratically elected board with a, you know, cadre of gay bashing sycophants selected by Governor Snowflake himself. And in episode 717, we described how Disney outmaneuvered DeSantis by having the Reedy Creek Board essentially assign all of its powers to Disney on its way out the door. I love that, which they were all too happy to do. You called those the princess contracts, and that's amazing. And we are going to keep that language.
Right. Well, they did defeat any change to Florida's rule against perpetuities law by tying the contract to the lives of King Charles's grandchildren, the youngest of whom is Princess Lilibet, who lives in California. So that seems appropriate.
Yeah, I love it. You know, Meatball Ron wasn't going to take that lion down, so he proceeded along two equally stupid tracks, right? So one of them was having his pet board retroactively invalidate the princess contracts, which, you know, we told you was all sorts of illegal, and that led to Disney filing their lawsuit literally an hour after that happened. That was fun. We broke that one down for you in episode 734. And then the second track that DeSantis went down was having his trolls in the Florida State Legislature pass a law amending Senate Bill 1604 and declaring the princess contracts illegal. And that's also not a thing that the legislature can do. But what we didn't clock at the time was how those two tracks actually intersect, right? But Disney's army of lawyers did figure it out. They've now moved to dismiss the CFTOD's lawsuit as a result, and it is glorious.
It is. Okay, so procedurally, let's summarize how we got here. Remember, it took the CFTOD board several weeks to discover those princess contracts because monitoring public meetings of a board you're seizing control of is apparently, you know, too much trouble.
Yeah.
When they did finally show up to work, though, they were hopping mad. One board member tweeted a warning saying, Disney has once again overplayed their hand in Florida. We won't stand for this and we won't back down, which, you know, the wanking motion is employed.
Yeah.
Okay. So on April 26th, the CFTOD met and formally disavowed the Princess contract on a bunch of basically spurious legal grounds we broke down for you in episode 734. Also on April 26th, Disney sued the CFTOD in federal court to block the effort to invalidate the Princess contract.
Right.
Disney managed to serve all the parties in that suit on May 1, although I would note that as of like yesterday, there was filing from the state's attorney, Ashley Moody, saying like, well, we don't really think you managed to affect service, but we're gonna pretend that you did. I mean, they're so ridiculous. I'm pretty confident that Disney knows how to.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah. On May 1st, the CFTOD filed a lawsuit seeking a declaration that the princess contracts are void and unenforceable and or invalid, and in order enjoining Disney from enforcing them. But they didn't file that countersuit in federal court like normal people. They filed it in state court.
Sure.
Right. And DeSantis, who is, after all, the animating force behind this idiotic exercise, vowed to introduce legislation that would, quote, make sure the contracts are revoked. Mm-hmm. And the very next day, the legislature introduced SB 1604, right, as we just told you. It says, an independent special district is precluded from complying with the terms of any development agreement or any other agreement for which the development agreement serves in whole or part as consideration, which is executed within 3 months preceding the effective date of a law modifying the manner of selecting members of the governing body from an independent special district from election to appointment or from appointment to election. Well,
yeah,
it's clear as mud, right? The Prince's contract had, of course, been executed within 3 months of the transition from RCID's elected board to CFTOD's appointed one.
Right.
So under this confusingly worded legislation, the contracts would be rendered immediately void and unenforceable, you know, by the law itself. So right. Let's go back to the timeline. SB 1604 was passed on May 5th, purporting to nullify the Prince's contract. And here's where we get to that oopsie. On May 8th, Disney's very good lawyers amended the federal complaint to add a challenge to SB 1604.
Right.
The next day, the CFTOD's less good lawyers amended their state complaint, too. Let's let Disney explain it. They say, on May 9, CFTOD filed an amended complaint in this suit that only corrected its signature block. Despite Senate Bill 1604 being signed into law 4 days prior, that law giving CFTOD the precise relief it requests here, CFTOD added no mention of the law in its amended complaint.
So, from a legal perspective, that's some serious side eye, right? Like the signature block is just the lawyers who have signed on to that complaint. So, you know, the court doesn't care who you are. Yeah, that's shade.
Mm-hmm. But it is a mere appetizer in this delicious feast of schadenfreude of a motion to dismiss, which points out that SB 1604 effectively mooted the CFTOD's case by rendering the Prince's contract void and unenforceable by unequivocal legislative fiat. Mm-hmm. Let's read. It says, that legislation renders plaintiff's complaint moot because it makes any order this court could issue in either party's favor legally irrelevant. If the court rejects the board's claims on their merit and agrees with Disney that the contracts complied with any procedural and substantive requirements of state law, the board would still be prohibited from complying with them under the new state statute. For the same reason, even if the court found merit in the board's objections to the contracts, any order to that effect would be pointless because the contracts would already be void under the new state statute. In short, any declaration about the contract's enforceability, voidness, or validity, either way, would be an advisory opinion with no real-world consequence. Trial courts in Florida are forbidden from issuing advisory opinions, and this case should be dismissed. Womp womp. Okay, so in plain English, there's nothing left for the court to decide because right. the CFTOD's lawyers were too stupid to amend their complaint to add SB 1604. So if the contract is illegal under state law, then the court can't make it like doubly illegal, right. you know. And even if it occurred to CFTOD's lawyers to amend their complaint to address SB 1604 now, mm-hmm. Florida's principle of priority says that state courts are required to refrain from adjudicating claims when the same issue and parties are before another tribunal, which they are, right?
Right.
So even if Florida's Ninth Judicial Circuit Judge Margaret Schreiber decides that the state case is somehow not moot thanks to DeSantis' dumb law, she's probably still going to have to dismiss it because the case is already pending before federal Judge Mark Walker in the Northern District of Florida in Disney's lawsuit.
Well played, Ron. That is precisely the kind of leadership and judgment that will take you to the Republican nomination.
Yeah, although I'd note that in the past couple of days, DeSantis and the CFTOD moved to disqualify Judge Walker because he made a couple of offhand comments about Disney being targeted for its woke speech in a different case. So we will see how that one goes.
I wouldn't hold my breath on that.
Yeah, well, me neither. We'll break down our next story after this brief ad break.
Hey, everybody. This is an ad for ZipRecruiter. You know, lots of sectors of the economy are booming right now, including e-commerce, healthcare, hospitality, just to name a few. If you need to hire qualified candidates ASAP for any of these industries or any other industry, you need ZipRecruiter. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OA. Look, I hear from small businesses all the time, and I know that growing your team can be a real pain point. ZipRecruiter makes it easy. They use powerful matching technology to find the qualified candidates for a wide range of roles. And if you're offering a unique job, ZipRecruiter offers attention-grabbing labels that speak to job flexibility, like urgent, training provided, remote, and much more. Let ZipRecruiter keep your team growing strong no matter what the industry. Four out of five employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. So see for yourself. Go to our exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OA. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
And we are back.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Democracy simply doesn't work.
And for our second story, in 2022, a bunch of right-wing goobers got together and formed the Ready for Ron, which is a political action committee to, quote, draft Florida Governor Ron DeSantis as the Republican Party's nominee for president in 2024. Yeah. And they enlisted the help of longtime Republican political operative, dirty trickster, and person with whom I got drunk underage with back in college, Ed Rollins. whom you may remember as once upon a time the guy who resigned from chairing the 1992 Ross Perot presidential campaign on the grounds that Perot was, you know, too crazy to be president. So, you know, better times.
Okay. For the record, Perot was too crazy to be president. He was a crank. Oh. And, you know, I'm not mad at Ed Rollins for it.
I would take Perot every single day for the rest of my life to have not had Donald Trump. But anyway, so Ready for Ron. Oh, really? Interesting. Okay.
For the rest of your life?
Well, you know.
That's a hard one.
It's a tough one.
Okay.
For the rest of his life, right?
There we go.
All right. So Ready for Ron was formed pursuant to a 2011 court decision that was called Kerry versus FEC. And it was a hybrid PAC. And they're in fact now called Kerry PACs as a result of that decision, right? So what a hybrid or a Kerry PAC can do is they can engage in both hard money contributions to candidates that are subject to campaign finance limits, as well as make soft money independent expenditures on behalf of campaigns, right? And look, in this story, you and I are going to emphasize a bunch of times that our campaign finance system is definitely broken, okay?
Yes, it is.
And we're not particularly given to both sidesism. These kinds of carry packs are things that both sides do, in fact, use all the time, right? So one of the really, really good examples of that is Emily's List, right? The early money is like yeast that supports women candidates. And notice, by the way, that one of the ways in which carry packs typically work is because their hard money contributions are capped at, you know, about $3,000, if you are supporting a bunch of different candidates, it makes sense. So Emily's List, other carry packs, they can fund candidates directly, and then they can make soft money expenditures in the form of, you know, advertisements, voter registration, get out the vote drives.
Okay. Right. So Ready for Ron set up a website with an online petition inviting dimwits to electronically sign a statement inviting Tiny D to save America from, quote, grave danger from the radical left and their failed socialist woke policies. Okay, simmer down. So this thing reads, Dear Governor DeSantis, please accept this petition to express the widespread public support to draft you to become and remain a candidate for the Republican nomination for president in the 2024 election, and when nominated, a candidate for the office of President of the United States. All of the signatories below have virtually signed this petition to demonstrate their support. They provided Ready for Ron with their names and contact information to convey to you as part of this petition on their behalf. So in case you didn't, you know, catch that last sentence where I was acting all crazy, this is not a petition. It's clearly not a petition. This is a mailing list. Mm-hmm. And as of this writing, 200,000 people have put their names on.
Oh, gosh. but yeah, I'm going to despair for the future of the Republic for a few seconds. But back to the legal analysis, right? A mailing list is definitely 100% a thing of value under the Federal Election Campaign Act, right? And even carry packs are ostensibly regulated from giving an in-kind contribution, a thing of value, to a candidate under their hard money restrictions, right? So that not only caps the amount that they can give that we alluded to earlier, but it requires those carry packs to document how the money was raised and spent, right, in a way that is more exacting than the soft money stuff that they raise, right? Now, as you're thinking about this, you probably picked up on my use of the word candidate back there, right? Because technically speaking, Ron DeSantis is not an officially declared candidate in that he is not, filled out the form two to be president of the United States. And so you might be thinking, okay, can you evade by not declaring yourself a candidate? Turns out that's not the definition that Congress uses to determine whether the Federal Election Campaign Act applies. Instead, under the law, 52 U.S.C. section 30101 subsection 2 defines it as follows. defines it as follows. Says, the term candidate means an individual who seeks nomination for election or election to federal office. And for purposes of this paragraph, an individual shall be deemed to seek nomination for election or election, A, if such individual has received contributions aggregating in excess of $5,000 or has made expenditures aggregating in excess of $5,000, or B, if such individual has given his or her consent to another person to receive contributions or make expenditures and they exceed $5,000. So note that the law has both a general purpose of statement, right? Who seeks nomination for election, right? That's the catch-all, as well as the bright line test of either raising or spending more than $5,000. So, right, one of the things that that's meant to do is to prevent you from evading the law as a would-be candidate by, you know, raising $4,999.99.
Yeah, yeah, we've seen that trick recently with George DeValder Santos and his $199.99 disbursements. But, okay, to be fair, there is a case to be made for allowing potential candidates to explore whether it's feasible for them to become a candidate. And that means raising money to conduct polls, traveling around their district to see if they can line up volunteers, etc. Sometimes people do that exploration and then they decide not to run, right? Mm-hmm. The polls show them getting killed. There aren't volunteers. They can't raise money, whatever. They decide never to run.
Right.
And it's not inherently unreasonable to say at the end of the day that if you decide the support isn't there and you're not going to run for office, that you don't have to register with or report to the FEC. But that led the FEC to create the testing the waters exception in the 1970s.
Yeah. And those regulations are 11 CFR section 100.72, right? And it says, funds received solely for the purpose of determining whether an individual should become a candidate are not contributions. Example of activities permissible under this exemption if they are conducted to determine whether an individual should become a candidate include, but are not limited to, conducting a poll, telephone calls, and travel.
Right. So here's how that breaks down. If you're testing the waters and you decide not to run, you don't have to register or report to the FEC, even if you raise more than $5,000, which, you know, it's not that much money.
Right.
On the flip side, doing stuff like calling yourself a candidate or raising more money than what is reasonably needed to test the waters are all the kinds of things telling the FEC that you've moved from testing the waters to campaigning.
Right.
So you've probably spotted the loophole in this regulation as written that would let candidates raise way more than $5,000 while, quote, testing the waters, declare as a candidate, and roll those leftover funds into their official campaign war chest without having to declare where they got that money.
Right.
So in 1985, the FEC revised the exemption to require that all funds received under the exemption were made subject to the Act's limitations and prohibitions. So that revised rule was intended to clear up any misconceptions that testing the water provisions may be used to raise seed money for prospective candidates. Which totally happened. Right. You know, that's how do you know what people were doing? What did they pass laws to say you can't do that? That's what they were doing.
Right.
So that means large donors can't use the exemption to evade hard money contribution limits, and prohibited sources like, say, foreign nationals and governments can't use the exemption to make otherwise unlawful contributions.
Yeah. And that all makes total sense. So let's go back to section 100.72. These are the 1985 amendments. It says, the individual, that is, person exploring who decides to become a candidate, shall keep records of all such funds received while testing the waters. Such contributions must be reported with the first report filed by the principal campaign committee of the candidate, regardless of the date the funds were received. Right? So that's exactly how the problem you were describing was solved. It means that even though you don't have to report funds to the FEC if you're just testing the waters and you decide not to run, you do have to account for all of them if you do run. Because, you know, otherwise, you're right, Russia, if you're listening, could help you, test the waters, right? Yeah, maybe we shouldn't be laughing about that.
No, I'm laughing.
We have to, or else we would cry, right?
Right. Okay.
And regardless of whether you do or do not decide to run, you have to comply with the contribution limits under the FECA and the source prohibitions at all times.
Okay. Of course, political operatives are going to try and find ways around the hard money limits.
Uh-huh.
And that takes us back to our pals at Ready for Ron. Your friends and mine. As we told you, maybe not. As we told you back in episode 614, the Federal Election Commission is pretty much busted at the moment due to the deadlock engineered by Donald Trump. And Biden still hasn't fixed it, which, hey, dude, take your time.
Yeah.
That has allowed the Trump campaign to skate by on hundreds of millions of dollars of obvious and corrupt campaign violations because none of the Trump appointees will vote to trigger enforcement mechanisms against Trump or really any Republican.
Yeah.
So Ready for Ron took itself over to the FEC and requested an advisory opinion in the hopes that the FEC might bless this effort to turn their donor list over to DeSantis.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So you have to let me rabbit trail just a little bit here.
Of course. Okay. I just called you a nerd. I think I got to be extra nice to you today.
But this is a really, really interesting bit of procedural geekery, right? And I know some of our listeners, right, like me, heard you use the phrase advisory opinion, right? And, and their ears went up and they were like, hey, wait a minute. I seem to recall opening arguments talking about standing a lot, right? Like, and that's right, because Article 3 federal courts, right, the federal courts that you think of, absolutely positively cannot issue advisory opinions. It's one of the things we've told you over and over again for 746 episodes, right? They can only resolve actual cases and controversies. But the Federal Election Commission isn't a court. And so what the Federal Elections Campaign Act sets up is this kind of quasi-judicial process. That's its own rabbit trail. I will skip it for now. But we'll do quasi-judicial proceedings at some point on the show. Anyway, so it sets up this kind of quasi-judicial process that people can request advisory opinions from the FEC as to whether, and here's the language that it uses in the statute, a specific transaction or activity by the person is legally permissible. That's 52 USC section 30108 subsection A subsection 1. Right? Okay. And look, like, the FEC then is required, when a candidate or person makes that request, to accept public comments on that request and issue a response within 60 days, provided that they have, and again, more of the statutory language here, the affirmative vote of 4 of the 6 members of the commission. Right now, you've just said it tends to split 3-3. So if 4 commissioners are unable to agree on the content of an advisory opinion, then what the FEC issues instead is a response stating that it was unable to approve an advisory opinion by the required affirmative vote of 4 members. Right. So we don't know. Right now, if the FEC issues a favorable advisory opinion, then the party who requested the opinion and any person involved in an identical transaction or activity to that described in the request may rely in good faith on that opinion and will be protected from any adverse legal consequences if they do it, right? So it's a safe harbor, right?
Right, which is why they want it, which is why the Ronettes want that.
That's exactly right. And everybody similarly situated to them, right? So,
right.
But the important thing is, only a favorable advisory opinion provides that safe harbor. If the FEC says, we don't think you can do this, right? Or if they deadlock, right? If they say, we don't know, right? We're unable to muster 4 commissioners one way or the other. And then you do it anyway, right? Then the FEC or the DOJ can prosecute you for violating the law, right? So you're only protected if they say, bless. So Ready for Ron went to the FEC and said, hey, we've got this petition. We'd like we'd like to give it to DeSantis. So tell us if we can. And then they broke it down. They said, tell us if we can give it to him, 1, before he tests the waters, 2, while he's testing the waters, but not a candidate, and or 3, when he becomes a declared candidate. And I think the Ready for Ron people were hoping that they could somehow, you know, skate on number 2.
Uh-huh.
Right. Yeah. As you point out, like, that would create a safe harbor for lots of other groups to do the same thing and, you know, continue to kind of get around these hard money requirements.
Right. But it turns out that no, that was a bridge too far even for this FEC. The commission did deadlock on number one, that is whether Ready for Ron could turn over the list before DeSantis tested the waters. Mm-hmm. But even these Republican commissioners agreed that they absolutely positively could not hand that petition, you know, that mailing list competition over to DeSantis while he was testing the waters or became a candidate. And obviously, that ship has sailed, right? He's not testing the waters. He's clearly a candidate now in all but name. So no giving the mailing list to Ron DeSantis for him to be persuaded to run for president. Womp, womp.
And more on that womp, womp after this brief ad break. This is an ad for Shady Rays, the sunglass sponsor that shares our values over here at OA. So Shady Rays makes high-quality sunglasses that are available at a fraction of the price of, you know, the expensive brands I'm talking about. So if you're like me and, you know, occasionally you've left your sunglasses on the roof of your car before driving away, or, you know, heard that unsatisfying crunch when you sit down in your seat, right? You will never worry about that again, because every pair of Shady Rays is backed by their industry-leading Lost and Broken Replacements program. So you take them out of the box and break them the second you get, they will send you a replacement pair for free. If you order a pair and you don't like them for any reason, you have 30 days to exchange or return them for a full refund. That's customer service. And as I suggested at the beginning of the ad, with every order, the Shady Rays Impact Program works with nonprofits to benefit children and young adults, like building playgrounds for pediatric cancer patients. So, what's better than getting one pair of Shady Rays and not worrying if you break or lose them? Why? Getting two. So head on over to shadyrays.com/opening. Use our code opening. And for a limited time, when you buy one pair of Shady Rays, you'll get a second pair free. That's shadyrays.com/opening. Code opening to get a second pair of Shady Rays free. shadyrays.com/opening. Code opening. And we're back. So, as you might suspect, right-wing crazies with a list of suckers aren't just going to take womp womp for an answer, right? Like, so nope. In October of 2022, Ready for Ron filed a lawsuit seeking declaratory and injunctive relief that it too can evade campaign finance laws. And I'm just, I know that this is a semi-serious lawsuit, but I'm going to quote from paragraph one right at the beginning, just to give you a taste of the hyperbolic rhetoric that they teed up and delivered with a straight face. And this is just never a good idea. Anyway, they state as the summary of their lawsuit, "This is a remarkable case in which the Federal Election Commission seeks to prohibit literal, pure political speech. Ready for Ron is a political committee which seeks to draft Florida Governor Ron DeSantis as the Republican nominee for president in the 2024 election. It has prepared a petition expressing support for Governor DeSantis and encouraging him to become and or remain a presidential candidate, running advertisements to invite people to sign it. To date, over 80,000 of Governor DeSantis's supporters have joined together to sign the petition." And sidebar, as you pointed out, that's now 200,000 today, but, you know, back in October of 2022, it was only 80. Anyway, either via the internet or by telephone, Ready for Ron wishes to provide its signed petition, including the names and contact information provided by its signatories, to Governor DeSantis, which is a traditional form of political expression and association. The commission, meaning the FEC, has issued an advisory opinion concluding that the Federal Election Campaign Act prohibits Ready for Ron from doing so while Governor DeSantis is either testing the waters or once he has become a candidate. So, yeah, what they care about is literal, pure political speech that, so happens to contain full contact information from which one might solicit future campaign contributions from 200,000 suckers.
Yeah, I mean, there's one born every minute, but even this is ridiculous. You know, simmer down, people. Right. So this complaint asked Judge Randolph D. Moss of the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, an Obama appointee, to issue preliminary and permanent injunctions prohibiting the FEC from applying to any regulations implementing the law against Ready for Ron in the event they turn over the donor list or use general soft money carry funds to pay for the expenses relating to the petition. And for good measure, they've also asked for declaratory relief, holding that the underlying statute and the implementing regulations are unconstitutional unconstitutional, which would blow up the testing the waters regulation in its entirety. And maybe they want a pony too. Who the hell knows?
Sure. Why not?
Right. So spoiler alert. No, you're not getting that.
Yeah.
Judge Moss first held that, duh, the list was obviously a mailing list and not a petition.
Right.
He wrote, some clarification is in order at the outset. The FEC stresses that it sees no problem with RFR providing its petition, complete with the list of signatures, to Governor DeSantis. Its only concern arises from RFR's plan to provide Governor DeSantis with the contact information of the signatories, because that compilation of contact information is, in all but name, a mailing or contact list. As a result, RFR's framing of this case as one about its petition is inaccurate. Rather, the dispute is about the contact list. Going forward, then, the court will refer to the operative item as a contact list unless the accompanying petition is somehow relevant.
Ouch. I mean, you know, has Judge Moss been reading your stuff? That's pretty good.
Yeah, that was a little catty.
Yeah.
But I'm not mad about it.
No.
Okay. So basically, that's the ballgame.
Yeah.
Because the case law is pellucidly clear that mailing lists are a thing of value under FEC laws, not the least of which is because campaigns routinely rent or buy those very lists.
Right.
So Ready for Ron's only hope was to say, like, no, this is definitely expressing a political opinion that involved us delivering this list. The political opinion was the delivery of this list, as it said in the damn petition itself.
Yeah.
So Judge Moss skewered them for their obvious duplicity. He said, RFR argues that whatever the word gift encompasses, it cannot include a petition because a petition is pure political speech. That contention rests on a faulty premise. Although the text of the petition and the list of associated names constitute core political speech, the same cannot be said for the contact information. RFR never explains why John Doe at website, or John Doe, you know, with his phone number attached, carry meaningful expressive value above and beyond John Doe. And as explained, the FEC has indicated that it would not object to RFR presenting the petition without the associated contact information. So the information that the FEC seeks to restrict is not core political speech. It is contact information.
And I have to jump in because you kind of yada, yada, yada over the contact information. But what Judge Moss
did
here.
Oh,
God.
Sorry.
No, it was so funny because the example he gives is, you know, John Doe at website.com or John Doe, and then lists the fake phone number as area code 123-867-5309.
Oh, did he? I didn't notice that.
And I got to tell you, when a federal judge wants to shout out to Tommy Two-Tone, like, we're gonna call them out here on the show. So big props to Judge Moss for one of the 80s best one-hit wonders.
I think it would be funnier if it was Jenny Doe, but...
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Anyway.
I'm proud of you on that one.
I get there.
Oh, and I have to flag one more bit of law geekery here, which it's tangential to the case because this was a dumb argument that was never going to go anywhere. But it's worth kind of breaking it down. And that is that Ready for Ron had an argument in the alternative that the court called attempting to reframe the issue. And it went something like this. It said, OK, if we lose on the whole this is political speech stuff, the regulation still shouldn't apply to us because we're not giving over a thing of value to Ron DeSantis. We're just a conduit for the thing of value, right?
Uh-huh.
The value is given by each of these 200,000 signatories themselves, right? So the value is their contact information. We're just, you know, passing that along, right? And the significance of that as a legal argument is that if it's 200,000 individual contributions, if each individual name and 867-5309 is its own thing of value, then that individual contribution would be de minimis, right? And it would not count against hard money in the same way that, you know, like, you don't have to itemize the paper clips that you give over to the campaign, that sort of thing. So, you know, they're not handing over a check for $1 million. They're handing over, you know, 100 million pennies one at a time.
I mean, okay, props for creativity, but come on, dude.
Yeah. Well, and that's why, look, like that's the court that had no difficulty seeing through that one, too. And Judge Moss noted that the act, quote, recognizes the concepts of conduits and conduit contributions, which are also known as earmarked contributions. And the key test there, if you're going to make this argument, okay, Ready for Ron, folks, is that It's the act of packaging it together that renders it the thing of value, right? So, right. So here's what the court said. Here, the FEC concluded that RFR's contact list was not properly considered a series of individual contributions from each signatory because the thing of value that RFR proposes to provide to Governor DeSantis does not consist solely or even primarily of any individual signatory's name or contact information. Instead, it lies in RFR's collection and compilation of the information from tens of thousands, if not millions of individuals nationwide, who would have already demonstrated their support for Governor DeSantis and his potential presidential campaign by participating in RFR's petition project, a project on which RFR plans to expend considerable resources of its own. That determination was not only reasonable, but unassailable, is what the court concluded. It has taken RFR nearly a year of work, over $1 million, and considerable initiative to identify and solicit the hundreds of thousands of signatories of its petition and to amalgamate their contact information into a contact list. Had RFR not expended that time and money, no such list would exist. RFR's labor and expenditures have thus created a uniquely valuable asset, the value of which cannot be attributed to the individual signatories.
Yes, because 100 million pennies is still worth $1 million.
Exactly.
So, okay, if you're wondering, are RFR and similarly situated groups worse off now than they were before they brought this lawsuit?
Oh, please.
The answer is yes.
Yeah.
because although the FEC deadlocked on whether they could evade federal election law before the testing the waters phase, Judge Moss had some strong opinions about it. And, you know, that's a binding judicial opinion.
His count, yeah.
yeah. So he said, the question on whether the FEC was unable to reach a majority decision is whether RFR may provide the contact list to Governor DeSantis before he begins testing the waters, if, in fact, he has not already begun to do so. He did not add, like, of course he's begun to do so. Shut up. Okay. In the court's view, the premise of this question is confused because the FECA contemplates no scenario in which an individual may accept contributions in excess of $5,000, which RFR's contact list is, without either becoming a candidate or, under FEC regulations, testing the waters. The answer to this question is thus no different from the answer to the preceding questions. RFR may not provide its contact list to Governor DeSantis. If Governor DeSantis were to accept RFR's contact list, he would become a candidate for federal office or would at least be testing the waters. Either way, providing the contact list to Governor DeSantis for free would constitute an excessive and unlawful contribution. One might reasonably argue that anyone who accepts a contact list like RFR's, an item that meets the statutory definition of a contribution with a value over $5,000, necessarily becomes a candidate in all relevant respects. Mm-hmm. That is, after all, what FECA says. A candidate is one who seeks nomination for election or election to federal office, and an individual shall be deemed to seek nomination for election or election if such individual has received contributions aggregating in excess of $5,000. The only possible applicable carve-out from FECA's plain language is the testing the waters exception, and this exception might apply if Governor DeSantis accepts the contact list as part of an effort to determine whether he should become a candidate.
Yeah, and the beautiful part there is that that distinction wouldn't matter, right? If he's testing the waters or if he's a candidate, the FEC has already said those are right out. So in other words, the way in which answering that first question comes into play is the act of tendering the list itself transforms you from pre-testing the waters to at least testing the waters. Mm-hmm. I have to tell you, my favorite part of this opinion is then when the court explains that it's really making this ruling to help out both Ready for Ron and the DeSantis campaign.
I'm sure they're really grateful.
Yeah, this might be slightly disingenuous, but I love it. Okay. Judge Moss says, of course, if RFR offered the petition to Governor DeSantis and he chose not to accept it, he would not thereby be testing the waters or become a candidate. But the only sensible way to evaluate RFR's request is to assume that Governor DeSantis would accept what is offered. To hold otherwise would derive RFR of any possible access to the safe harbor, since RFR does not know and has no reason to know whether Governor DeSantis would accept the contact list. And thus, RFR would send it to him at its peril. And I love this part. And it would deprive Governor DeSantis of the ability to test the waters without the fanfare of a public campaign to require RFR to obtain a commitment from him of his intentions before requesting an advisory opinion or seeking review in the court. So they conclude. But whether accepting the contact list would make Governor DeSantis a candidate for all purposes or whether he would fall within the limited testing the waters exemption, the result is the same. The Federal Election Campaign Act's contribution limits apply, and the value of the contact list exceeds those limits. There is, therefore, no scenario in which Governor DeSantis could accept the contact list without triggering FECA's limitations.
Yeah, I don't know about you, Andrew. I read that not only as a massive subtweet of DeSantis and the RFR people, but of the ridiculous campaign finance system itself. Like, if we have to play these stupid games where you have the supposedly independent, you know, carry PACs or whatever they're called, like, acting separately, and they're not coordinating with the campaigns, and it's a total sham. The whole thing's a sham, right? Like, it's all of this soft money is totally perverting our system. I think that Judge Moss is definitely making a tongue-in-cheek commentary on this, the system which Citizen United and Chief Justice John Roberts have blessed us with.
Yeah, I think that's the exact right way to read some of the frustration in that opinion, which, you know, may have been left over from some of Judge Moss's clerks writing the bench memorandum that I imagine, you know, they probably also have strong feelings about the current status of campaign finance law. But either way, good on him and good result.
Exactly.
And if you want to stick around in the Patreon bonus, we're going to give you a little bit of an update on the arbitration and efforts to collect $5 million from Mike Lindell that we previously broke down on the show. If not, thank you so much for listening, and we will see you in a couple of days.
See you guys.
You got into Harvard Law?
What, like it's hard?
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Liz. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Spotify, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, with assistance from Teresa Gomez and Deborah Smith.
Opening Arguments is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, copyright 2023, all rights reserved.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.